From Feature Story News in Washington, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, a special edition of our programme, a book conversation with a British pioneer. Kate Ady was one of the first women to blaze a trail as a frontline television news correspondent on the BBC. Now she's written a new book about some earlier women who blazed a trail during World War I.
Unless as a reporter, you report on all of it. I feel you don't actually report the war. And really, in European terms, the first war that involved everybody, women included, at home as well, was the First World War. And I thought, they ought to be reported on.
That's Kate Ady talking about her book, Fighting on the Home Front, The Legacy of Women in World War I, after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The White House has welcomed Britain's decision to join airstrikes against Islamic State militants in Iraq. UK parliamentarians voted overwhelmingly on Friday to approve airstrikes after British Prime Minister David Cameron insisted the country was morally bound to act. The decision is seen as significant because British lawmakers voted against military intervention in Syria last year over the use of chemical weapons. Earlier in the day, Belgium and Denmark also pledged their aid in the fight against ISIS, promising to deploy fighter jets. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said the British vote shows the coalition effort against ISIS is broadening.
The United States and the United Kingdom have a special relationship, and we are pleased to see the strong support from members of Parliament for members of the British military working alongside U.S. servicemen and women in pursuit of this goal that benefits countries all around the globe.
Three firefighters who helped with the 9/11 rescue efforts in New York have died of cancer on the same day. They are among hundreds of people who have died since the terrorist attacks of illnesses linked to toxic dust from the wreckage site. Nick Harper reports from New York.
Fire officials have confirmed that the three firefighters died within hours of each other on Monday. Howard Biscoff, Robert Lever and Daniel Hegland were all on duty on September the 11th. And helped in the clear-up of downtown Manhattan following the collapse of the Twin Towers. Although it's not clear if their cancer was directly linked to the attacks, thousands of people who helped in the rescue efforts have been diagnosed with illnesses, and hundreds have died as a result of the toxic gas thrown into the air. A $2.7 billion compensation fund is due to expire in 2 years unless the US government votes to extend it.
Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas has blasted Israel's recent campaign in Gaza during a speech at the United Nations. Mr. Abbas described the war against Hamas as genocide. Steve Mort reports from the UN.
Speaking through a translator, Mahmoud Abbas lashed out at the recent Israeli offensive in Gaza.
In this year proclaimed by the United Nations General Assembly as the International Year of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, Israel has chosen to make it a year of a new war of genocide.
Calling for a UN Security Council resolution backing a return to pre-1967 borders, Mr. Abbas described Israeli settlers as racist and armed gangs. He said any plan for Israel to withdraw from occupied areas must include a firm timetable. The U.S. is expected to veto such a resolution tabled in the Security Council, instead favoring a plan to strengthen the current ceasefire in Gaza while seeking improvements in security and economic conditions there.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. President Barack Obama says combating the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is a top national security priority for the U.S. and says it needs to be a priority for the world. Mr. Obama was speaking from the first annual Global Health Security Agenda Summit in Washington. He outlined a three-pronged strategy to improve the world's reaction to health threats.
Prevent, detect, and respond. We have to prevent outbreaks by reducing risks. We need to detect threats immediately wherever they arise, and we need to respond rapidly and effectively when we see something happening so that we can save lives and avert even larger outbreaks.
In his remarks, the president thanked South Korea, which will host the conference next year, and Japan, which will donate 500,000 pieces of protective gear to health workers in West Africa. Barack Obama also challenged inventors around the world to design better health gear for workers, which the U.S. hopes to fund and distribute in West Africa within the next few months. Russia and Ukraine have reached a preliminary agreement over the supply of natural gas to Ukraine. A resolution to the dispute would prevent the potential disruption of gas flow during the critical winter months. Iris Spitzer reports from Berlin, where the talks were held.
Under the terms of the agreement, Ukraine would pay $3.1 billion by the end of the year for gas that has already been delivered, in exchange for Russia supplying gas in the coming months. The European Union brokered the deal, as Europe depends on the flow of Russian gas through Ukraine for about 15% of its demand. Russia's Gazprom, the world's largest producer of natural gas, raised the prices after the Russian-backed government in Ukraine was overthrown in February. They cut off supplies in June amidst increasing tension between the two sides, citing unpaid bills. The agreement still depends on the approval of both the Russian and Ukrainian governments. Iris Spitzer, Berlin.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. Today, a special edition of our program featuring a woman whose name will loom large when the history of broadcast news is written. Kate Ady is not widely known in the United States, but in Britain she was a fixture on the BBC for decades. One of the first women on the front lines of television news, her dramatic reporting transfixed audiences and helped persuade the men who ran the industry that women could do just as good a job. She was in Libya in 1986 when US missiles rained down.
Within sight of our seafront hotel, a series of flashes and a low rumbling indicated that the intended targets were well within the city. After a short while, the Libyan defences went into action. Red tracer bullets, anti-aircraft fire. The sky filled with an evil firework display.
She was in Tiananmen Square in 1989 when China's communist government repressed its own people.
A huge volley of shots just as I left the front line caused panic. The young man in front of me fell dead. I fell over him. Two others were killed yards away. Ambulances screamed up to the troop line and were turned away. They couldn't get to the square. Two ambulance drivers were shot and injured. Two more people lay wounded on the ground near me.
And she was in Iraq 2 years later when Allied forces tried to oust Saddam Hussein from power in Operation Desert Storm.
Just a few minutes after the deadline passed, I went outside the tent here and listened. And you can hear the sound of the bombers droning overhead towards the border, towards the Iraqi positions. And they go inexorably, minute after minute, more and more bombers. So I suppose that is one sign when you're quite near Iraqi positions that things are not changed from the past few days, but they have a certain sense of inevitability now.
Retired now, Kate Ady has turned her attention to a new topic, the role women played in World War I. It's the subject of a book she's written called Fighting on the Home Front. And in this extended interview, she talks about it with Ian Dale of Britain's LBC Radio.
It's interesting that you've written about women in World War I, because I was thinking now, without reading the book, what would I know about women in World War I? And I would think, well, they worked in munitions factories and they got the vote after World War I. That's probably about the sum of my knowledge.
And two famous women, and they would be Edith Cavell, and we're not far from her statue,
indeed,
which is in central London, who was the nurse shot as a spy for helping prisoners to escape from the Germans. And the second one was Mata Hari, who was a woman of what would in those days called very doubtful background, who again was shot as a spy by the French. And that's almost typical. A very virtuous nurse and a woman of dubious morals. And it's that kind of extraordinarily conventional image. But other than that, there are scores of women who did fantastically interesting things and who've just faded into nothingness, apart from the millions of women who made the war, well, they won the war in one sense, because if they hadn't made the munitions and done all of that dangerous work, there would have been defeat on the front line. So it's a fantastic story, because some of them are real characters.
Why do you think the role of women in World War I has been so overlooked?
Well, I think there are two things here. First of all, historians tend to be male, and also generals write the memoirs and the histories. And of course, things like the guns, the weaponry, the tactics, the strategy, what happens with soldiers, and the great awfulness of war endured by the men fighting is the most important thing, because the outcome depends on them. Mm. And secondly, I've always felt as a reporter, whenever I've been anywhere where there's a conflict, you look at modern war today and ordinary women are in it, because there is no battlefield. You know, nobody sort of marches off to the outskirts of town and says, oh, actually, at 11 o'clock, you know, if you draw up your horses and I'll go there with mine, we'll say start, we'll have a battle. That's what a lot of people like to imagine in various terms that war is about, with rules and... Well, but that's all out the window
you,
now.
You look at the conflict in Syria.
And, totally.
And, I mean, women are just as involved in that war as men in many ways.
Well, in fact,
ways.
You see more pictures of them, because there are no front lines, there are no set battles. It's just a nasty, dreadful, violent internal conflict fought house to house between, you know, going through people's kitchens and down through the shopping and the market alleys and things like that. And it's women who are displaced. They're also killed in bombing and shelling. And therefore, unless as a reporter you report on all of it, I feel you don't actually report the war. And really, in European terms, the first war that involved everybody, women included, at home as well, was the First World War. And I thought, they ought to be reported on, just like I do it today.
Do you know, I often wonder how, if 24-hour news had been around in World War One or World War Two, whether those wars would have turned out in the same way, because they almost couldn't have been fought in a 24-hour news age, could they?
You can say that, but there is something which interferes with that idea, and that is that you would be allowed to report. One of the problems with Syria right now is the number of journalists missing. And it's quite a high toll of deaths for what is not a very widespread conflict. A lot of dead journalists. And a lot of governments make it perfectly clear that if they see a journalist coming, they'll shoot them. That's it. And that, it does more than deter.
Yeah.
So you can imagine, but the actual practicalities of it are quite questionable as to whether it would change the nature of warfare.
Now, when you were writing the book, I always wonder when somebody writes, particularly a history book, how do you just, where do you start? I mean, how do you sit down and think, right, OK, this is the first thing I'm going to do?
You don't sit down. You spread on the floor various post-it notes and bits of paper and things you find in your handbag, which you thought of on the tube. And they've got two words on them, and they're all over the place. And you go, and then you spend several days, you know, sort of banging your head. Mm. But then I started to follow certain things which I knew a bit about. I wrote a book some years ago about women in uniform, the history of women in this country, and quite a few others about what it was like to actually get into uniform. So I knew a certain amount there. And I sniffed after that. And the other thing I did is I thought I'd try and look into munitions. And one of the first things I did was went up to the northeast to probably, though somebody may ring in and say, no, she's wrong, probably the only remaining 1915 factory built for the war where they produce munitions, which was still up to a very short time ago producing stuff for the heavy armaments industry up in the northeast. I'm walking into the building. It was the stink of it that reminded me as a child from the northeast and heavy industry of what we don't get nowadays. This huge, great, unpleasant-looking building with walls streaked with soot and dirt and oil and muck.
Not many of them around now.
No. And these were the buildings into which people went to do the horrendously long hours, and sort of got the feel for it, so that everything I read from then onwards, I tried to imagine women getting up at 3 in the morning in order to walk a long distance, possibly to get a train, possibly, down to this factory from Tyneside, and then start a 12-hour shift with hardly a break.
And I suppose we ought to think that for many of these women, it would be the first time that they'd probably worked.
Well, there were already women in domestic service, but nobody took any notice of them. It's the servants. You know, that was it. They didn't actually count a lot in ordinary statistics. When it talked about the world of work, the Ministry of Labour just counted the blokes. And those hundreds of thousands, in fact, probably a million or two women who were lugging coal upstairs, scrubbing floors, you know, peeling potatoes and polishing everything and running around for the mistress of the house. They were ignored. A great number of those shifted off into munitions because they were paid hardly anything. But quite a large number of women had never worked before, and because the government was so determined to keep the country going, because it wasn't just munitions. Hundreds of thousands of men went from transport, the railways, from the post office, the civil service, from ordinary businesses. And the only people really, the government realised, and a society which didn't actually think much of women, said, oh, I suppose we better get the women to do it. And they became, for almost the first time, essential.
And presumably it was quite dangerous work. And there a lot will have lost their lives.
Heavy engineering was horrible. I mean, elephant safety had not been invented.
No.
These machines, great lathes and all of the cutting gear, all of the sort of stuff which you needed for armaments in factories for making tanks. The first tank was virtually made by an all-women force in Lincolnshire. And it was horrible. One of the things you notice with engineering workers and also the munitionettes is they wear little mob caps. Oh, cute. And people think, what a nice little fashion statement. They got their hair caught in the machinery and were scalped in the first few months. So there were so many dangers. They were wearing long, long skirts. It got caught. There were horrendous accidents. And there was not a lot could be done about it. Some of the women took to wearing trousers. Revolution.
Surely not.
Yes. I mean, there was great opposition. But it was a practical thing. And in the munitions factories, the explosions and, you know, women lost fingers. They lost their sight. There were horrible things done. And in about four or five instances, entire factories blew up. There was an enormous, great explosion in the East End of London in the middle of the war, where it was said you could hear it in Kent and Essex. There was another one in Scotland, where it was said 4 hours into the fire at night, 4 miles away, you could read a newspaper by the light of it. People were killed in large numbers. It was dangerous, but the women were prepared to do it. And they went in to, you know, because they were both patriotic and they were paid a bit more money. Half what the men got for doing the job.
Kate, we've talked about sort of the fact that this was the first time that a lot of women actually even had any experience of work. They weren't paid as well as men. I suppose at that time, no one would have expected that. But what do you think the lasting legacy of the fact that women did actually do this is? Because we know that women got the vote after the First World War, but I suspect that there are a lot of women in the workplace today that had that not happened. I mean, I suppose at some point in the 20th century things would have changed, but it would have taken a lot longer.
But one of the things you have to sort of look at and say, what did they achieve? Is you see where they were in 1913, when the war broke out, 1914. Men used to get up in Parliament and say things like, you can't give women the vote because they have smaller brains. And if they were to have to make big decisions, their brains would boil. That was sort of acceptable. It was also thought if women learnt too much, it was a very common view, which came down Victorian times, that if they actually took in too much education and learning, their wombs would shrivel.
But it's okay for them to be queen.
As long the exceptions were interesting because it was thought that if you were very well bred, then probably you were made of sterner stuff. There was quite that sort of attitude. And
that's probably the other way round.
Oh, very much so. And Women were patronised. They had very few rights. They did not have the vote. They could not enter most of the professions. The few who were doctors, they couldn't be surgeons. All of these things were the situation in 1914 when war broke out. At the end of the war, they had proved they could shoulder responsibility, they could do tough jobs, they hefted sacks of coal down at the gasworks, they did road mending, they went into the munitions factory knowing it was dangerous, they took over jobs in the post office, in the civil service, the Bank of England, and they did the job. And what they did was prove that women could do it, because before the war, people said, no, they can't possibly. No. And they could. What they didn't achieve, of course, was to convince everyone that they should do it.
But even 50, 70 years later, I mean, I remember when I was, 17 or 18, watching a party political broadcast by Margaret Thatcher just before the 1979 election, where she had to do this thing straight into the camera and try and reassure the men in the country that she as a woman would be capable of doing the job. That was only, 35 years ago?
Look, the first woman, women drove buses in the First World War, and they did all sorts of jobs on the railway. They finally got to drive buses and trains within living memory of very young people.
And you still look twice, frankly, if you see a female bus driver. I do. I know it's terrible to admit, but I do.
Really? Yes. Don't
I think I've said the wrong thing there.
But the point is, it does take time. And the reason it's taking time, because the revolution isn't over, is it has been the biggest, I think, revolution in society ever. Because right through history, women have been number two. They have been second rate. They have been without rights. They have been subservient to men, with tiny exceptions here and there, right across society. To shift that, to change it, and to convince everyone, women as much as men, because it involves, if you get your rights, you take on responsibilities, takes a long time. We still can't work out what's called work-life balance. There are agonised letters from the suffragette movement during the war saying there are women going on 12-hour shifts down at the munitions factories, and when they come back, having done their 12 hours and probably travelled a couple of hours either side of that, they have to see to the brood of children. And women had a lot of children. No one was looking after them except maybe a few elderly neighbours.
No free childcare.
Yeah, and they had no welfare, no childcare. And so all of these women were thinking, there is a problem here if women go out to work and children need looking after, but they need the money, otherwise they're all going to starve. So they were thinking about that 100 years ago, and we're still thinking about it.
When you started out on your journalistic career, was there any part of you that thought, well, look, I want to break into this male-dominated world?
Because, I joined as the most junior radio station assistant in local radio eons ago, when dinosaurs ruled the Earth, and we were the first local radio stations in Britain. My first job was to feed the station cat. Because
I'm sure you did it well.
Well, yeah, we had to, because they had greater status than me, because we had mice and they were chewing through the cables in the studio. So cat had status, you know. So I learnt my business from the sort of bottom up, doing all the stuff around studios, which you have to do, and seeing what people do and that sort of thing. I never thought of it as a career. I just thought it was such an exciting thing. Mm. I'm sitting now in front of a microphone. Do you know,
it's what we love, isn't it?
It's fantastic. And I've been allowed to do this. And I've been also, later on, I went out as a reporter. I didn't join journalism. I did lots of things before I went into the news side of things. And I found I went with television news and a camera to extraordinary places, saw amazing things. And I thought, fancy that, me doing it.
But you did break into a male-dominated world, because you were a war reporter, and I can't think of many other, at that time, female war reporters.
Yes, but there were also no female judges, no female chief constables.
But you couldn't have done it all.
There are so many things. There was still a lot of change happening when I came in 30-odd years ago, and so. And I never thought of it as breaking through, because I thought that when you went out to report, it's always been my thought, You're reporting on everyone. I never saw... Admittedly, you were faced with serried ranks of suits if you went to the Bank of England, the House of Commons, a bunch of lawyers. It was men, and it often still is. But I didn't see it that way. I thought, he just hears interesting people, and I've got questions to ask them.
But when you're out there doing war reporting, and you're there with the people from CNN and goodness knows where else who are predominantly men, I mean, it must be a bit of, there's a bit of a club of war reporters.
Well, they weren't in the 1980s and 90s, I can tell you, because I remember we all ended up in Sarajevo for about 4 years, going in and out of there. And CNN's, CBC's... ABC's reporter, myself, and the French reporter for etc. were all women.
Oh, really?
Now that was at a time. Well, no, that was at a time when women felt they had to take the job if there was the chance, and all of them said, "If I don't do this, all the men will say, of course." Doesn't do the real job, doesn't go into conflict, etc. I mean, I never felt it like that. I just did it as another story and got the opportunity always just to say, right, I'll go. It's always been, because it's a male, it's a male area, since the caveman took up the first club. You see, the caveman took up the first club. Mm. So it's always been seen as a male subject. But I feel very strongly, particularly, as you mentioned, Syria today, we ought to report the world as all of it is. And that includes women. And I think that's the only honest way to do it.
And there must have been times when you probably felt quite frightened in the situations that you were in, but did you feel...
What a delicate phrase. Well, I have other phrases for it, and I have felt it all. I have actually been gibberingly scared to death.
There was that spitting image thing of you, sort of this Kate Adey, head of bravery, and I remember thinking at the time watching that once, I bet she gets as scared as the rest of us.
Okay, I get more scared, I mean, because I've seen worse, possibly. If you don't get scared, you don't understand what people are going through. Yeah. If you're indifferent to it, and also you're a bit of a liability, the ability to leg it, to hide behind things, because as a reporter, you've got to stay alive and bring the story back, is quite something. And so, yes, you get scared, and you understand also the people you're reporting on are having to live through this, and they're scared in their own living room because there are gunmen coming in through the window, and you realise how awful it is.
So we've only got about 45 seconds left. What's the one memory that you've got of the time when maybe you thought, maybe this is it?
There are several, but I didn't think this is it. What I was doing was thinking, I've got to get out of this. I've got to get my crew out of it. We've got to do something. Mm. And so your brain, my life, my small and unimportant life, did not go in front of my eyes in a second. I was just thinking, what are we going to do? Action. And that's what's kept me alive.
That's Kate Adey. She was in conversation with Ian Dale, the Drive Time host on Britain's LBC Radio. Her book is called Fighting on the Home Front, The Legacy of Women in World War One, and it's published by Hodder and Stoughton. And that's FSN Reports for today. Don't forget to tell us what you think of the programme. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. I'm Simon Marks in Washington. For everyone with FSN everywhere, thanks for listening. Goodbye.